So this week we're doing Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 38. So the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. Now, according to Venerable Anālaya, this discourse takes its occasion from a monk taking consciousness to be a permanent self, in reply to which the Buddha gave a detailed exposition of dependent arising, paticca samuppada. This discourse has a parallel in the Majjhima Agama, which is Majjhima Agama 201. And moreover, there's a few lines have been preserved in a Sanskrit fragment, which is a few lines of the conversation between the Buddha and Kevataputta, or I think between the monks and Kevataputta. And also there are some other fragments or parts of the sutta which are preserved elsewhere in the Chinese, which we'll refer to later on. So this particular discourse is one of the longer discourses that we find in the Majjhima Nikaya. When I first started editing the printout that you've got, it started out at 20 pages, so I managed to get it down to 4 pages. So you'll be grateful when we come to do the chanting that we don't have 4 pages. Takes about nearly an hour to chant. The way we chant, so if it was 20 pages, there'd be 5 hours chanting. So that's good that we managed to edit it. But of course, there is a lot missing from the text you've got there. So as always, I try to edit it so that the important bits are there, but a lot of the dialogue and so on is missing. Now, this particular discourse has a lot in common with one that we studied a few weeks ago, the Alagadupama Sutta. Now, both of them quite substantial discourses, very profound discourses, and among the most interesting and philosophically sophisticated suttas found in the Pali canon. And moreover, both of them start out with a similar setting, that is when you have a bhikkhu who's misbehaving himself and has found that I've got a kind of a wrong view, not necessarily wrong behavior, but a wrong view. And it's interesting that in both of these cases, this seems to stimulate the Buddha to give a kind of a very powerful discourse, yeah? And so the fact when he's kind of challenged with someone with the wrong view, sort of rather than giving the same old everyday discourse he might have given every other day, suddenly he comes out with something really special and really sort of hammers it home. So this is a good technique to remember. We used to do this with Ajahn Brahm sometimes when we were staying in Perth, before the Wednesday night Dhamma talk. Just like 10 minutes before we'd go up to the hall, we'd bring up a question with him about something we knew he'd get him riled up about. And and then we knew we were going to get a really good Dhamma talk that night. So it's really something to bear in mind. So the particular sutta, dealing with dependent origination, now it doesn't give us the detailed exposition of the meaning of the terms of dependent origination. We've already seen that in the Samadhiatti Sutta, and also found the Mahanidana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, and also many times in the Sanyutta Nikaya. So this doesn't give us the word definitions of dependent origination, but it does give us some very interesting treatments of dependent origination and put it in some interesting context. And particularly important here is the context of the Brahmanical background, presumably Brahmanical background, doesn't actually say that, within which the Buddha was teaching. And this has been pointed out by many Indological scholars, and I think it's one of the great contributions of European Indological scholarship, is that they have to some degree managed to resuscitate the ancient Indian background to a lot of these discussions and debates and ideas and controversies and so on, which the later Buddhist traditions tended to lose sight of. Okay, so the later Buddhist traditions were not familiar with the same texts that the Buddha's audience was familiar with. They weren't familiar with the Upanishads and the Vedas and so on. And so they tended to miss a lot of the references to such things. So just on the parallel versions from the Chinese Majjhima Agama, I won't be referring to that very much, simply because the Chinese version is almost identical with the Pali version. Apart from the translator makes one or two mistakes in the Chinese, and a couple of bits are a bit different, but basically the bulk of the sutta is almost the same. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove Anathapindika's park. Now, on that occasion, a pernicious view had arisen in a bhikkhu called Sati, son of a fisherman, thus. So, notice that in the Ilagadupama Sutta, he was formerly a vulture killer. Yeah? So he was, it's not a particularly kind of noble or high caste kind of job. And here he's the son of a fisherman, which is also, of course, a very low caste kind of job. So it seems to be a bit of a slur going on these guys. Sati, the son of a fisherman, said, "As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another." Okay? So this is the central doctrine that the whole sutta revolves around. Okay? Dataham, thus I understand, Bhagavata, by the Blessed One, Dhammang, you know Dhamma, Desitang is taught, Ajanami. So I understand, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One. And this is kind of a standard phrase when you're reporting what you think the Buddha's teaching to be. Okay? Yata tadevidam, okay, vinyanam, sandhavati, sangsarati, ananyati. Okay, so the important part here is tadevidam. Okay, here is that eva means that very, it's like an emphatic particle, meaning exactly that or just that very consciousness, idang, is this. So this very consciousness, this very same consciousness is what this is saying here. Vijnana. Okay, so vijnana is a crucial word, obviously, in Buddhist philosophy. Now, the root is jnya, okay, the Sanskrit word jnya, meaning to know. Okay, and this, of course, very, very ancient Indo-European root, which is the same root as the English word to know, and many other words in English have the same root. Now, what actually does vijnana mean? Okay, now we'll get some idea of what vijnana means a bit later on, but it's certainly not at all obvious. And these kinds of words, philosophical and psychological words, we have to play around with them. We have to deduce bit by bit here and there what they mean in different contexts. It's not immediately obvious what they are. One problem with the word in English is that it's almost always translated as consciousness, but the word consciousness in English usage has many different kinds of meanings. Okay, it doesn't always mean the same thing as what we mean when we mean vijnana in Pali, and so this can lead to some confusion. So if I find some definitions of consciousness here: an alert cognitive state in which you are aware of yourself and your situation. It's an English definition of consciousness, okay? As in, he lost consciousness. Or awareness, having knowledge of, as in, he had no awareness of his mistakes, or his sudden consciousness of the problem he faced. Okay? So that's some definitions. Here's another definition. Consciousness is a quality of the mind generally regarded to comprise qualities such as subjectivity, self-awareness, sentience, sapience. I don't know, what does sapience mean? Well, but it's different from sentience. Sorry? Sapience is wisdom, yeah? Sentience, so like intelligence, yeah? The ability to perceive the relationship between oneself and one's environment. Okay? So that's from Wikipedia. So from Caltech, the University of California University of Technology, as preserved. At this point in the scientific exploration of this phenomena, it cannot be defined rigorously. Consciousness usually, but not always, involves some form of attentional selection and a rapidly decaying form of information storage. Or from, there's another definition, a philosophical explanation of what consciousness is or how it might be explained eludes us. If we stick to what it is like to be a conscious human being, we have no explanation. If we try to explain consciousness in terms of what goes on in our brains, the sheer feel of consciousness itself, isn't it? It cuts off. I'll have to find that in a minute. Okay. Another definition. A state of being. Awareness of difference. One is at a certain frequency, time mode, or paradigm, aware with a way of differentiating depending on the knowledge of the self, the body and the culture. So that's a pretty out there kind of definition. A more straightforward definition, when you are fully awake and your brain is working normally. And here's a Hindu definition. Ishvara uses this term to describe what some might call God. The term God, however, usually refers to some other, thus implying an outside controlling force. The consciousness is a wholeness, a synergy made up of individual unique parts. Force. All right? So there's some very different ideas of what consciousness is, isn't it? And that's a very spiritual idea. And that particular one is relating to the Upanishadic idea, which we'll come to in a moment. But I'll just a couple more. A mental faculty is being aware of one's environment, one's own existence, sensations and thoughts, to be mentally perceptive or alert, awake and capable of thought, will or perception. Does that sound fair enough? Being aware of one's environment, one's own existence, the sensations and thoughts, to be mentally perceptive or alert, awake and capable of thought, will or perception. Okay? So some very different kinds of ideas of what consciousness are. So this makes it problematic to try to refer to translate vijnana as consciousness. And particularly in psychology, consciousness usually means like the sum total of your thoughts and feelings. So it's more like a holistic thing. It's like your whole kind of mental world. It's very often used in that kind of way. Whereas it certainly doesn't mean that in Buddhism. So we'll come to see a bit more what it does mean a bit later in Buddhism. But just to notice that the translation of that as consciousness is problematic. Now, I've tried translating vijnana. Instead of consciousness, I've tried using cognition. And here we have some definitions of cognition. The conscious process of the mind by which one becomes aware of thoughts and perceptions, including all aspects of perceiving, thinking, and other stuff. The act of perceiving, thinking, reasoning, and analyzing. The mental process or faculty of knowing, including aspects such as awareness, perception, reasoning, and judgment. Knowing, awareness, perception. One of the advantages of cognition is that it has a verb form, whereas consciousness doesn't. Vijnana is often used in a verb form, so grammatically, cognition works better. Anyway, I don't want to solve all these problems now, but just to give some idea of what vijnana may or may not be, okay? So just in a way to problematize it. Sometimes what we find, and we've mentioned this quite a lot of times when we're discussing suttas and translations, is that when we're reading suttas in translation, is that we often tend to get hung up on the translation itself rather than looking at what the sutta is trying to say, okay? And so the particular words used in the translation are, of course, nothing more than the choices which translators have made to try to render the sutta as best they can, given their limited capacity. Okay, so that very same consciousness, sandhavati, okay, sandhavati, runs on, means runs through or transmigrates, okay? So generally it means to run, but actually in this context it means to be reborn in samsara, and here we of course have samsarati. Again, sar, the root sar, is to flow, and this originally was related to the idea of a stream and the flowing streams, okay, the rushing flowing stream. And this is especially kind of potent geographically in India because the Aryan people have moved down from the Himalaya and from that region, and so of course you have these amazing powerful rivers, the Ganges and many other rivers, which are very powerful. And so this idea of that flowing stream which is taking you away, if you'd have evolved Dhamma in Australia, then you probably wouldn't have used that kind of imagery in the same way. You know, it wouldn't have impressed yourself, yeah? You'd maybe use more imagery of the openness of the space or something like that. So these imageries taken from their environment. An anyang, which is not another, okay? So this is the important thing. It's that very same consciousness that roams and fares on, not another. Okay, that's the doctrine which is being proposed here by Sati, the fisherman's son. Now, the bhikkhus, having heard about this, went to Sati and said, "Friend, Sati, is this true, that such a pernicious view has arisen in you?" So the word for pernicious view, ditti gatang. Okay, so ditti is a view, and this phrase, ditti gatang, literally means just the state of having a view. You've come to this state, but it's almost always used in this sense of being a pernicious or wrong view. "Exactly so, friends. As I understand the Dharma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. Then those bhikkhus, desiring to detach him from that finisher's view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus, "Friend Sati, do not say so. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Blessed One." The Blessed One would not speak thus, for in many ways the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen. Paticca samuppannang vijñānang bhūtang bhagavata, said by the Tathagata, dependently originated. Okay? Consciousness is dependently originated. So this is the past participle form from paticca samuppada. Okay, so paticca samuppada is a noun, saying this is dependent origination. When you say something is dependently originated, you use paticca samuppanna. Okay, so although pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by these bhikkhus in this way, Bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, still obstinately adhered to that pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Okay, tamasa, obstinately, strongly. Paramasa, misapprehending. Abhinivisa, insisting on it. Okay? Since the bhikkhus were unable to detach him from that pernicious view, they went to the Blessed One. And, paying homage to him, sat down, told him what had been going on. The Blessed One called the bhikkhu to him. And then questioned him about the view. And Sati confirmed that he did in fact hold that view. And then the Buddha asked him, then what is that consciousness? Okay. Katamantang Sati Vijñānang. So what is that consciousness? Okay. So here Sati gets to explain his view a bit more. So notice when the bhikkhus were asking before, they didn't actually question him about it. So this is always the Buddha's way, yeah, to ask and inquire, well, what's actually going on here? What do you mean when you refer to this? What is this consciousness? Vyayang Bhante, is this thing Bhante? Vado, the speaker, okay? Vado, the speaker. Vedeyo, the experiencer, okay? That which feels, the feeler. Tatra tatra, okay? Here and there, okay? So tatra tatra is an idiom to mean here and there, and it's the same as found in the definition of the second noble truth, tatra tatra binandini, meaning being born in various places, being reborn in various places. Okay, kalyana papakanan. Okay, the good and bad, kalyana, as in Ajahn Kalyana, meaning beautiful, lovely, a very apt name it is too. Papakanan, as in, I won't go into that, but papakanan, kamana, good and bad deeds, result, the ripening, okay, fruition, experiences, okay? So that which is the speaker and the experiencer and which here and there experiences the result of good and bad deeds, okay? So that's right, I've forgotten to do some grammar this one. Normally we try to do a little bit of extra grammar with each lesson. And review the old grammar as well. So this week, let's do the ablative and instrumental cases. So we've done the nominative case here. We have Bhagava, okay? The nominative is the subject of the sentence, so the doer of the deed. The Anyatarang Bhikkhung, a certain bhikkhu. So this is the accusative case, often ending in the ng sound. And the accusative singular, this is usually the object, okay? Now, we've also briefly, I think, remarked upon the vocative case. So here the vocative is just very simple. It's just used to in a term of address. So when we say a bhikkhu or bhante, something like that is the vocative case when you're just talking to somebody and refer to them. And we did, last time we did the dative and genitive cases, the dative case meaning something for something, okay, and the genitive case meaning something of something, something belonging to something. So here we have a dative and genitive plural, the results of, okay, so this is a genitive plural, the results of good and bad deeds. So padliana papakanang, kamanang, this is the genitive plural. Okay, so this week we'll do the ablative and instrumental. I remarked last week with the dative and genitive that they have the same forms, so they always look the same, and the meaning also often overlaps. Okay, with the ablative and instrumental cases, Also, the meaning often overlaps, and also they often have the same form, but they don't always. Sometimes they have a different form. Usually, the most common forms we find for the instrumental, if it's a stem ending in a short A, the instrumental form is ena, the ending, and the ablative ending is a long A, ah. Okay, but that's just the most common forms that can appear in many different forms. So let's have a look as we go along and see if we can notice any of these. Okay, so how can you, foolish man, Moga Purisa, understand the Dhamma taught by me? Okay, so here we have Maya, the Dhamma taught by me, and this is an instrumental case. So instrumental having the meaning of by, with, or through something. Okay, so the Dhamma taught by me, Maya meaning by me. Okay, okay, haven't I in many ways, okay, and again here an instrumental case, aneka pariyayena, the way or means is a pariyaya, aneka, eka is one, aneka is not one, and this is an idiom meaning lots. So in Pali, if you want to say lots, you say aneka, means countless. Aneka pariyayena, in many ways, so through many ways or with many ways, I have spoken of consciousness as dependently originated. Okay, so these are some of the ways that the instrumental case gets used. I might just read a couple of passages from or that relate to what I think these ideas, and particularly looking at the Upanishadic context, and it seems to me very likely, almost certain, that when this terminology is being used, it's actually basing itself on a usage which had become, which had emerged in the in certain kind of esoteric, philosophical, mystical circles within the Brahmanical schools in the centuries prior to the Buddha. So when I was doing the studies for History of Mindfulness, I did a little bit of research into this, and it really struck me very strongly, one particular passage, which I put in my book. I've read this out a number of times in sutta classes, so if you've heard this before, then bad luck, you have to hear it again. And Venerable Mahesi's been here for, heard this passage many times in sutta classes, as has Natasha and those people who've been around for a while. But I'm going to read it again because I think this is really crucial for understanding the context of the Buddhist usage of some of the terminology like vijnana and so on, and also the word ekayana, which is very important in the context of Satipatthana. So this particular passage, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka is the largest, the earliest and the most important of all the Upanishads, and it, probably most of the material in it dates from 100 or maybe 200 or 300 years before the Buddha. And the most important of the sages, the rishis, in this text is a fellow by the name of Yajñavalkya, okay? And he was absolutely pivotal in creating the Upanishadic conceptions. A lot of what we think of today as Hinduism, and especially the Advaita school of Hinduism, really derives from Yajñavalkya, okay? Even though the Advaita school itself didn't arise until 1,000 years later, more than 1,000 years later, maybe 1,500 years later, but Yajñavalkya's ideas were seminal in creating that. One of the things that happens here is the Vedic tradition, the old Vedic tradition, which the Brahmanical stream was originally based on, was very much a householder's tradition. It was very much about doing the rituals and so on for ensuring the fertility of the fields, the prosperity of the countryside and the family and all of these kinds of things. It was very kind of worldly. But there was this kind of otherworldly movement where these sages were moving towards meditation, moving towards contemplation, moving towards kind of higher philosophical conceptions. And this is pivotal in that movement. And here we have Yajñavalkya about to go forth. And of course, even this is a very radical innovation within the Brahmanical tradition. Going forth is something that wasn't in the old Vedas. It wasn't this conception of the sannyasin. So Yajñavalkya is about to go forth, and he's speaking to his wife, and speaks to his wife Maitreya. Maitreya, I'm about to go forth from this state of householder. Look, let me make a final settlement between you and my other wife, Katyayani. So he had two wives, Maitreya was the one who had wisdom. Katyayani was good at women's business. I mean, she was good at cooking and cleaning and stuff like that. Then Maitreya said, "If indeed, venerable sir, this whole earth was filled with wealth were mine, would that make me immortal?" "No," said Yajnavalkya, "then your life would be like that of the rich, but there's no hope of immortality through wealth." Then Maitreya said, "What should I do with that by which I do not become immortal? Tell me, sir, what you know." Then Yajnavalkya said, "My dear, you have been dear to me in the past, and now you speak dear words. Come, sit, I will explain to you. Reflect on what I say." Okay, so here, not only is Yajnavalkya going forth, but his wife is also wants to learn about the profound doctrines. And of course, at this stage in the Brahmanical tradition, there obviously was no restriction for women to learn these kinds of things, as there was at later times. So I won't read all of this, but just abbreviate some of it. Then he said, "Truly, not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear, but for the sake of the self. Not for the sake of the wife or the sons or wealth or Brahmanhood or Kshatriyahood or worlds or gods or beings, or for the sake of the all is the all dear, but the all is dear for the sake of the self. Truly, Maitreya, it is the self that should be seen, heard, considered, and reflected upon. By the seeing, hearing, considering, and cognizance of the self, all this is known. The Brahman ignores one who knows him as different from the self. The Kshatriya worlds, gods, beings, all ignores one who knows it as different from the self. This Brahman, this Kshatriya, these worlds, these gods, these beings, and this all are the self." And then it talks about the place of convergence. As the ocean is the convergence of all waters, the skin is the convergence of all touches, the nose is the convergence of all smells, the tongue is the convergence of all tastes, and so on and so forth. Just as a lump of salt thrown in water becomes dissolved in the water, and there would not be any there to be seized by the hand, but wherever you might take it up, it is salty. So too, this great being, infinite, with nothing beyond it, is a sheer mass of cognition, of consciousness, vijnana ghanameva. Having arisen out of these elements, one perishes back into them. When departed, there is no more perception, no more sanya. This is what I say, dear. So said Yajnavalkya. So here, he's building up this kind of whole thing of talking about all the duality of the world and all of the different things that are out in the world and all of the things that you might value or think are worthwhile in the world, and referring them all back to the self, all coming back inside. And then says, this self actually is this sheer mass of consciousness, vijnana ghanameva. Okay, so this is this idea of identifying the great self with consciousness, and this is one of the keys to Yajnavalkya's teaching. Maitreya said, "Now I'm really confused when you're saying this." And Yajnavalkya said, "I'm not saying anything confusing. This is enough for you to understand. For when there is a duality, as it were, there one smells another, one sees another, one hears another, one speaks to another, one thinks of another, one cognizes another. But when all has become identical with the self, then by what and by whom and whom should one smell, see, hear, speak, think? By what and whom should one cognize? That by which all this is cognized, by what is that to be cognized? By what, dear, should one by what, my dear, should one cognize the cognizer?" Okay, very beautiful, especially that last paragraph. How do you know the knower? Yeah, how do you know that which knows? Yeah, you can know the sights, the sound, smell, taste, touch. You know all those things, but how do you know that which knows? Yeah, this is a question that Yajnavalkya is making. Now, of course, from the Brahmanical tradition, then they identify this with the self. Okay, because it's the last thing, which is the last mystery of life. Yeah, you can know everything. You can go into the library, you can learn everything in the things. You can look through the telescope and see all the stars. You can look into the... You can know everything about everything. But how do you know the knower? How do you actually know that which knows? This is like saying, you know, how do you... You know, you can take a picture of anything you like with a camera, but how do you take a picture of a camera with the camera, yeah? Yeah? So this is that question. And so when they became face to face with this mystery, then from that background, that tradition, they were searching for a self. They wanted to find a self. Then it was very natural that this should be the thing that they identified as the self. Okay, so here's, I'll just give you one other example. This one from the Sutta Nipata, very beautiful collection of Buddhist poems. The Metta Sutta, Mangala Sutta, Ratna Sutta, and other things are in here. And particularly at the end, my favorite section is this section called the Sola Sapanha, 16 questions in the Parayana Vagga. And this has 16 Brahmins who all approach the Buddha and ask him questions. So, of course, they're obviously asking from this Brahmanical perspective, okay? And this is one of the most interesting ones here, is Upasiva's questions, okay? So here's the questions of Upasiva, and a great series of verses here. Alone and not dependent, eko ahang sakam hantama ugahang, okay? Alone, I'm not able to, and not dependent, anisito, I'm not able to cross over the great flood, okay, Mahanta, Oghang, okay. The Sakyan with the all-round vision, Samanta Chakhu, teach me an object, teach me something to rely on, an aramana, okay, depending on which I can cross over the flood, okay. So it's interesting because normally you ask the teacher to not rely on anything, yeah. Here he's saying, no, I need something, I need a crutch, yeah. I need something to lean on, you know, give me some support, I need some support, something, give me something to lean on, what can I support myself on, okay. So what does the Buddha say? He says, you've got to support yourself on something. What do you support yourself on, right? What have you got that's solid, substantial, enduring and lasting that you can lean on? So typically being the Buddha, he says, okay, depending on nothingness, okay? You can cross over the flood, okay? Kintanyang, okay? On the nothingness, having regard for nothingness, being mindful. Natiti, thinking there's nothing. It doesn't exist. You can cross over the flood. Okay? Having abandoned sensuality, virato gatai, and freed from doubts with the destruction of craving, tanha kaya, same word as we have in our title of our current sutta, and abstaining from, what does it say? Abstaining from wrong conversations. Okay, not the mahabhibhasa, right. Okay, and then Upasiva asks another question. So somebody who's vitaraga, who's free from lust for all sensual pleasures, okay, and who's dependent on nothingness, so this means dependent on the base of neither, of nothingness, a third of the formless attainments, and he hit manyan, okay, he's left everything else behind, and he is released in the ultimate release of perception, okay? Would he stay there and be not subject to rebirth and not come back there, okay? Okay, so you're dependent, get based on nothingness, right? And then you have this thing which is a bit enigmatic. You have this sanya vimoka, the release of perception, okay? So the Buddha's answer, he basically says, yes, someone who's freed from all sensual pleasures, so it probably means an anagami in this context, who's got the third of the formless attainments and has the sanya vimoka, he would remain there without returning, okay? It's a bit difficult to interpret. We don't necessarily need to solve all the interpretive issues here, but just to get an idea of the kinds of things that they were talking about. So, if he were to remain there, titen sotata, and without returning, even for many, many years, okay, pūgampi, vasanang samanta chakku tate, and if he was to become cold, okay, to cool down, okay. So of course it means to attain nibbana. Javeta vinyanang tatha vidhasa. Would there be consciousness for someone who is in such a state, okay? So that would there be consciousness? And so the reply the Buddha gives: ati yata vata vegena kitta, like a flame which has been tossed by a strong wind. Atang baleti na upeti sankang, it would go out and would not, literally would not come into reckoning. Okay? And no longer, translated here, no longer counts as a flame. Thus the sage, freed from that namakaya, okay? Here the namakaya, literally the mental body, or the name body, okay? And here, just to annoy you all with a bit of grammar. Here, namakaya is the ablative case, from, so released from the namakaya. Atang paleti na upeti sankang, he would go to the end and not come to a reckoning. So then upasiva, still not satisfied. Atangato so udava so nati udahue sasatiya arogo. So there's that one who's thus ceased or thus come to an end. Does he really not exist? So nati? Or does he exist in a blissful state, aroga, permanently, for eternity? So please explain to me the Dhamma. Atangatasana napamana mati, one who's come to an end, napamana mati, there is no pamana, which probably here means there is no way of knowing them. Okay? No way of understanding them. Yenanang vajung tangtasanati, there is no way of knowing them by which one would speak of them, that does not exist for them. Sabbesu dhammesu samuhatesu, when all dhammas have been uprooted, samuhatesu, it's a misspelling there, it should be samuhatesu, samuhata vadapatapi sabbeti, then all ways of speaking are also destroyed. Okay, so the point the Buddha is making a point here about knowability and describability. Okay, so there's no way of talking about somebody who has ceased. There's no way of knowing them. Okay.
The flame, once it goes out, there's no way of really knowing the flame, once it's gone.
Yeah.
Where's it gone?
Yeah.
Does it exist?
Yeah. So this is the consciousness, okay? So this is what's happened to the consciousness of somebody in this state. So this is kind of the ways that people were talking about the word vijnana in these days. So this is one of my favorite series of verses in the Sutta Nipata. So the Buddha's response, after being told, what's that vijnana? Haven't, misguided man, haven't I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness, but you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Yeah, it's a bit heavy, isn't it? Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and Vinaya? How could he, Venerable Sir? No, Venerable Sir. So all the monks. So, this is again, this is the same as the Alagadupama Sutta, and this kind of very strong admonition, and I noted the word before, usmikato, the kindle of spark of wisdom, which became a technical term for the sarvastivadins. Okay, then, as one might imagine, when this was said, the bhikkhusati, son of a fisherman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Okay, as you probably would be too, if that happened to you. Knowing this, the Blessed One told him, misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view. I will question the bhikkhus on this matter. Okay, so again, noting the use of the instrumental case here, sakena papakena dithi gatena, by your own pernicious view. Okay, etena, by this, your own pernicious view, you will be recognized. Okay.
It comes across as a little draconian.
Bit heavy, isn't it? Yeah.
But it would sort of encourage people to question doctrine.
Yeah.
Maybe it's some translated later.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be. It could have been made a bit more, these things could be made a bit more forceful, easily to make it a bit more heavy in the...
Sometimes you need to be forceful, though.
That's true. Sometimes it's also true.
People adhere to their views so perniciously that they're not going to let go and to give them admonishment to the state war. They realize, well, perhaps it is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's also true, yeah.
We're only given the blank slate of what is presented to us, but what the feeling of it would have been in that time, right?
Yeah, so hard to know.
You don't know his personality either.
Yeah, what's all this has led up to and so on, yeah.
And how he got that view.
Yeah. Okay, so then we go on to skip over a few paragraphs, come on to the conditionality of consciousness, paragraph 8 down here. Because consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. Yang yadeva bhikkhave pacayang paticca upadati vinyanang tena teneva vinyanang dueva sankhyang gacchati. Okay? Yang yadeva, whatever particular, eva here again meaning like a particularity, pacayang, whatever condition dependent on which arises consciousness, tena, by that, okay, so the repetition here, yang, okay, and tena, so notice these coordinate with each other, and they have a universalist emphasis in this particular context, so whatever. So if you just had yang bhikkhave pacayang, it would be by what condition it arises, okay, but yang, is the yad there is actually just a sandhi joining up the yang and the eva, it's actually yang, eva. Yeah, but spelt as Yang Yadeva, Bhikkhave. And so so instead of saying what condition, it's whatever condition. So the repetition is a distributive.
So the consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition depending upon which it arises. It means that consciousness has a different, can it mean that consciousness has a different flavor or different type of consciousness depending upon which condition it is, arises from?
Yep.
So that's depending on which sense.
Yep.
Sense door the consciousness arose.
Yeah.
So if it was taste, then that would have a particular flavour.
Yeah.
A particular thing to it. And same with hearing, it has a particular aspect to it. Is that what it means?
I'm not sure if that's what it means. I mean, I think that's correct, but here it's talking about the whatever it's known as, the sankhyang gacchati, whatever it's counted as or reckoned as.
So what?
How it's described.
Or what is this
described? Something that's not explicit.
Like I said, with like, well, people reckon that the sound consciousness, and that's what it's reckoned as.
Mm. Yeah. Vinyana dvaiva sankhyangacchati. Okay, so then goes through the six sense bases. Chakun chapatita rupe cha upajati chaku vinyanang chakun vinyanan dvaiva sankhyangacchati, and then it's known as the I consciousness. Okay, so consciousness that's arisen dependent on the ear and sound, then that's known as sota vinyana, okay, ear consciousness, and so on and so forth for all of them. Okay, and then gives an analogy with the kinds of fire dependent on fire. When fire burns as logs, it's log fire. When it burns on faggots, it's faggot fire. Here, faggot, just in case you think that the Buddha was into burning faggots, this is faggot meaning like a bundle of wood tied together, okay? There's no bundle of sticks, okay. Right. Faggot fire. When fire burns dependent on grass, this is grass fire. When it burns dependent on cow dung, it's called cow dung fire. When it's burned dependent on chaff, it's chaff fire, and rubbish is rubbish fire. Okay? So,
the thing to notice there is that in each case that they all reckon there's a different type of fire, but they're all fire.
Yeah.
In a sense, and so
they all burn.
Different types of consciousness, but they're all consciousness.
They're all consciousness, yeah. So they all, yeah. And all the fire has its, all the fire burns, right? So it all has that quality of being fire, but it all might be different. It might be hotter or colder or more or less smoke or these kinds of things. In the next section, bhutamidang. Okay. Do you see that this is bhutamidang? So this is this word which has come up for discussion a few times in the thing, but this word bhuta, and in the bhuta, often used, bhuta is just the past participle from the word to be, okay? So it just means it refers to something which is real or which exists or something like that. It's a very common word, all right? But in this particular sense, in dependent origination, it's used specifically to imply something which has been brought into being through conditions, so something which has been conditionally produced, okay? So this thing has been brought into being by conditions. Okay, do you see, right? This thing has been brought into being by conditions, okay? Yes, Bhante, monks answer. Tadahara sambhavanti. Okay, so it is produced with such and such a nutriment. Okay, so we'll be talking a bit more about nutriment a bit later on in the sutta, but here nutriment is a synonym for a cause or a condition. So whatever it is, it's come into being by being produced. And what do you see? That, so tadahara, not merely the fact that it's been conditioned, but it's been conditioned by this. Okay, it's got a specific condition. So this is what we translate as specific conditionality. Yes, Bhante. Tadahara nirodha. So with the ending of this, whatever has come to be, that also is subject to cessation. Do you see that? And then moving on to give a similar series of questions relating to different ways of looking. So the next one, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? This has come to be. Does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? Does its origination occur with that as nutriment? Does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus with the cessation of that nutriment? What has come to be subject to cessation? Okay. So going through the same pattern, these three things, but with a different emphasis in each time. Next one is doubt abandoned. So doubt arises. So now on page 352, a general questionnaire on being, is doubt abandoned? And then asking the monks, are you free from doubt here? This has come to be. Okay? Then asking them, has it been well seen by you as actually is, with proper wisdom, thus this has come to be? Yes, Venerable Sir. Okay. Okay, so this kind of whole question of series of questions about the kind of way in which the things around us that we have, right, whatever is bhuta, okay, whatever is real, whatever is around us, things we see, what actually are they? Okay, well, these are things that are conditioned. So whatever we're seeing these things are conditioned. They're conditioned with such and such a thing as cause, so they have a certain thing which produces them. Okay, now when we don't understand that, we don't know that, then we have doubt about it. We don't understand the world around us, but that doubt ends when we see that with right wisdom. Of course, right wisdom being the wisdom of stream entry here, yata bhutam. Okay, and so again, this word, notice that the connection here, this word yata bhuta, which we translate as it really is, but more properly would be translated as it has become or as it has been produced. And the word bhuta here, of course, being the same as the bhuta up here, as it has been produced. Yeah.
He understands that as it has been produced, thus in conditionality, in terms of it is conditioned.
It is conditioned, yeah, exactly.
To see it as it really is. Yeah.
Understanding its conditioned nature. Yep. Okay. Then, comes back to that question which mentioned briefly before, we're talking with Mal. If, monks, this view, this ditthi, okay, thus purified, okay, parisuddha and pariodata is very, very clean or bright. Odata literally means white, so pariodata is completely white. So if one were to adhere to it, aliyata, one were to stick onto it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession, so treasure it, dhanayeta, so it means literally to think of it as my precious, okay, and to think of it as mine, then would you be remembering, or would you be understanding the simile of the raft, okay, that I've taught to you, that Dhamma is for crossing over and not for holding on to? No, Bhante, okay? So, of course, this referring back to the simile of the raft, which we found before in the Alagadupama Sutta, I believe. Is that right? Yeah, Alagadupama Sutta, yeah. It's in that one, yeah. No, Hetang Bhante. No, indeed. Okay, and so to understand the Dhamma just for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of holding on to. And that's something that might be a difference between a stream enterer and an arahant. A stream enterer might still be attached to their right view. Okay, they have the right view. So what does it mean to be attached by it? I'm not quite sure, but what it might mean is that you might get upset if someone argues with you about it. You know, if you can get righteous about your views, you think, oh, I'm kind of right, and you can get head up. I imagine that an arahant wouldn't get head up. They might pretend to be just for the purpose of conforming with worldly conventions, right? I mean, certainly. But, or for entertaining the monks or something. Right. and they still don't have the wrong view. So here again, the question Mel raised about the dittigatang. So here this kind of view is not called dittigatang, it's just called ditti. Because it's just kind of the idiom that's used. Okay, moving right along. Now we have a question section on the four foods. 8:47. All right. Now you're going to have to go to the kitchen. See, this is synchronicity. Yeah, it's synchronicity, the four kinds of food. Maybe we can eat the four kinds of food for lunch. Okay? Now, this one is a straight-out quote from the Saṅyutta Nikāya, where the four foods feature in several suttas, and indeed in the Chinese, they have their own Saṅyutta devoted to food. There are these four kinds of foods for bhūtānaṁ vā sattānaṁ titiyā. So here we have this word bhūtā again. Okay, so these four kinds of food, bhūtānaṁ vā sattānaṁ. So sattā here meaning beings, and bhūtā also can mean beings, but here it has a meaning of beings that have been reborn into a particular state. Okay, so this is a past participle. So past participle means having arrived in a particular state. Okay, so one has sat down. Okay, so when you say you have sat, it means that previously you weren't sitting, but now you are sitting. Okay, so you've arrived in that state of being sitting. Now, Buddha is that kind of word. So it's beings which have arrived in a particular state of being. So for keeping them there, for maintaining them there. In other words, when you're born as a human being, you've got to eat, otherwise you pass away from the human realm and reappear somewhere else.
A good example for this food is nutriment is the maintaining beings is the kilopoetic endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, if they don't eat, they die.
That's right, yeah, you miss out
one meal.
Miss one meal and then you die. Yeah. Sambhavesi nangwa anugahaya, and for assisting the sambhavesis. Now this is very, very controversial. And the sambhavesi probably means those who are in an antara bhava, so in an in-between state. And so this is a great controversy in Buddhist circles, and one of the divisive doctrines which split the Buddhist schools. Most of the schools of Buddhism, including the Sarvastivadin group of schools, Pugalovadins, and I believe the Mahasanghic group of schools. I'm not 100% sure on that. But they all believed in an antarabhava. So they believed that after you died, then there was like a process where of moving from one birth into another birth. Okay. Now, other schools, such as the Theravada school, said that there's no in-between state. There's just like one life and then, boom, there's another one. Okay. But there's no, in the suttas, there's no one sort of decisive passage that says one or other of those things is correct. And this is usually where those controversies arise. Usually the controversies arise precisely because there are places where the suttas are not 100% clear and decisive. So the things that the suttas are decisive about, then controversies don't arise on those things. And so, nevertheless, even though that it's not 100% decided, still, many Pali scholars, including myself and Ajahn Brahm, and in fact just about everybody that I know who looks at these things based on the suttas rather than being primarily based on the Abhidhamma, has concluded that the suttas do in fact accept an in-between state. And there are quite a few passages that seem to refer to an in-between state fairly clearly. This one is not one of the clearer ones, as some Bhavesi mean ones who's to be born. This is grammatically unclear about what it is. K.R. Norman wrote a whole paper about it, the grammar of it. But it probably means one who's to be born. In this case, the Amarawati translation is probably correct. And so the idea is like in the simile the Buddha gives of rebirth in the talking about the divine eye, he said it's like someone who's sitting on a balcony, an upstairs balcony, and watching people coming out of one house, wandering down the road and then walking into another house, walking out of this house, walking down the road and walking into another house. Yeah, and so it's like this process of moving from one abode to another. And it seems that this is the kind of thing that rebirth is. It's a process of moving, and so this is what the Sambhavesi is, one who's house hunting, right?
House hunting.
Yeah? They're looking in the classified sections, trying to find where am I going to move to next, and they're driving around looking at this one. Is this any good? You know, oh, I don't know. And then trying going, and they're going, and they're not in one place or the other, but they're in this kind of in-between state. Finally, they make a decision. They move in. Okay, right. Sambhava sino ti ye sambhavang jati nibhatang e santi gave santi. Okay, so here it says whoever are seeking and searching for existence, birth, and reappearance. Herein, when the four yonis, four kinds of births, such as the under the egg born and the
spontaneously born,
and the so on, satta, yava andakosam vati kocha na bindati. Oh, okay, so as long as for those beings who are born in eggs and maybe in worms or something like that, as long as they haven't broken the eggshell or whatever it is, then they're called sambhavesis. Okay, but when they've broken the eggshell, then they're called a bhuta. They're called one who's being born. Okay, so here four foods. What for? The coarse food. Solid food, both coarse and subtle, which means stuff that you eat. Right? Paso dutiyo, contact. Manosan chetana, intention, will. And vinyanang chatutang, consciousness, is the fourth. This is a very interesting teaching on the four foods, and we haven't got time to go into it now, but four aspects of life. Right? So these things constitute aspects of life which actually keep us going and keep us maintaining us in existence. If we don't have these things, if any of those things are absent, then our life can't continue and we disappear. So these four foods, where do they originate from, and what are they produced? They originated from tanha. Okay. Now, in here we have again the start of a repetitive series on conditionality, but here just to notice the grammar here. The four foods, King Nidana, King Jatika, King Bhabava. Oh, hang on, no, this is the Nidana. Oh, yeah, no, this is not an ablative usage. Sorry, my mistake. Forget that. We've got an ablative coming up a bit later on, but don't need to get excited right now. Okay.
So, what are the four
foods? Four foods. Coarse food, stuff that we eat. Contact, just a second. Mano Sanchetana, mental intention, and consciousness. Yeah, if you don't have it, it's like the will to live. Yeah, will to live, exactly. And contact also, like stimulus, like if you don't have any sense stimulus, if you've got sensory deprivation, then you're not going to live and thrive.
What about the tests on babies? And they're only given food, they're not contact.
Yeah.
And that's pretty
different contact. Yeah, no, but it's a similar kind of thing, yeah. Okay, so, and then it goes backwards through dependent origination, from craving to feeling, feeling to contact, contact to sixfold sense bases, then to nama rupa, consciousness, formations, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates, sankhara, and ignorance at the beginning. Okay, so here we just have four synonyms for to originate or cause something. King Nidana, okay, is one word. Samudaya, another one. Jatika, okay, is born. Bhava, to be produced. Okay, bhava, again, the root to be, but meaning from or out of. Bhava, produced. Okay. So because with ignorance as condition, and then goes through the normal sequence of dependent origination. With ignorance as condition, there are sankharas. With sankharas as condition, there is consciousness. With consciousness as condition, there is nama rupa, and so on, and through to the end. Thus is the origination of this whole mass of suffering. And then, next, taking it backward with a questionnaire. With birth as condition, there is aging and death. So it was said. Now, because do aging and death have birth as condition or not, or how do you take it in this case? And they Bhikkhus reply, aging and death have birth as condition, Venerable Sir, thus we take it in this case with birth as condition, aging and death. Okay, so this phrase here, jati pachaya jara maranang. So this is the most normal way that dependent origination is phrased in this kind of standard passage here, avidya paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnanam, and so on. And here we do have the ablative case. So I'm sure you're all thrilled to learn that the word paccaya here, with the long A, is ablative, meaning from or due to. So ablative in this sense, using it as a causal sense. Okay, so due to ignorance is conditioned, there are sankharas, sankhara paccaya vijnana. Now notice a little detail here. It's a bit hard because this text is a bit small. But here in the first one, you have avidya paccaya sankhara, and avidya paccaya and sankhara both have a long A at the end. Okay, paccaya, and then sankhara. And so if you look at it, you'd think that they were the same case. You'd think that they agree with each other. Okay, but then when you look at the next one, sankhara paccaya vijnanam, okay, and then you realize that they don't in fact agree with each other. Okay, this first one is an ablative. The paccaya is an ablative. Sankhara is a plural form. So this is ablative singular. Sankhara is the nominative plural. Okay, but they just happen to share the same ending, just to keep you all on your toes. All right, now. So here, good bhikkhus. Thus bhikkhus, as you say, so do I say. Imasmin sati idang hoti, imasupada idang upajati. Okay? Again, this is being the classic phrase of what we call specific conditionality or idapachayata. Imasmin sati, this being, so this being in the locative case, idang hoti, imasupada in an ablative case, due to the arising of this, this arises or that arises. That is to say, avidya paccaya sankhara, and then through this the arising of suffering, and then flips it around to the reversal of suffering as well. Avidya yatveva asesa viraga nirodha. Okay, due to the ending of that very same ignorance, there is the ending of sankharas. And again here the ablative case, nirodha, from. So you can think of the ablative because it's a from. So it's got a long A, which sort of makes it go, you draw it out, so you go from this, yeah? So you can think that makes it easier to remember. This is the road, you're drawing it out. Okay, so then the questionnaire on that cessation. And now I come to section 23, is another interesting section. Because, knowing and seeing in this way, would you run back to the past thus, thinking, were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what did we become in the past? No, venerable sir. So this being the doubts about the existence in the past, present and future, which also I think is in the Alagadupama Sutta and elsewhere as well. So going back to the Pubbanta, that previous end, the past, the former end. What were we? Would you run forward to the future saying, how shall we be? Shall we not be? What shall we be? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? Knowing and seeing this way, would you now be inwardly perplexed about the present thus? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? No, venerable sir. So this is a very beautiful passage. I mean, these really encapsulate this whole kind of idea of existential suffering, existential despair. This is exactly what existential despair is. It's not a worry about livelihood or relationships or food or anything like that. It's a despair and a worry about actually what am I? What is this? What am I? What is life? What am I? And this is this kind of very deep level of kind of despair. Ahang nu kosmi, am I? No nu kosmi, am I not? God, King who calls me, what am I? Katang who calls me, how am I? This being here, where has it come from? Kuto, Agato, where's it come from? And where is it going to go? Yeah? Okay, so that's knowing and that's seeing. Would you speak, would you say, the teacher is respected as us by us, we speak as we do out of respect for the teacher. No, Bhante. What? They're not speaking out of respect for their teacher. Who are these people? No, Venerable Sir, would you speak thus? The recluse says this, that is the samana, the Buddha, and we speak thus at the bidding of the recluse. Okay? No, we don't do that. What would you... Okay, so it's almost like, well, you know, are you doing it because you rely on the Buddha or the Buddha's teachings? No. But then, would you go to another teachings? Okay, would you go to another? Would you go over to the site? Would you acknowledge another teacher? Well, no, Bhante. Would you fall back on so pacha gacheya ta? So this is a great phrase here. Pacha, pati, that meaning that's like re in English, re or anti, pati. A gacchati is to come or to come. So it's to come back on. Yeah, to come back and fall back again on. Agateya ta is a future conditional or something verb form, some kind of weird verb form. I think it's a future conditional verb form or something. And putu samana brahmananang, okay, of, so here we have the genitive case again, of the many samanas and brahmins. So knowing is saying those things of the many samana brahmins, the has it got it here, the observances, the vata, okay, the tumultuous debates and auspicious signs, okay, kotuhala, and the auspicious signs is mangalani, okay, would you go back to them, sarato, as the essence, okay. Now, sarato is another, this is a distinctive and idiomatic usage of the ablative case, okay? So previously we've seen the ablative, which in the normal or the most common masculine singular form has a long A, okay? Sara, and so here the word is sara, and so the ablative form would be sara, alright? But this has this particular idiomatic, this is another form of the ablative, sarato, which can mean from, as the normal ablative does, but here, and very commonly, it has an idiomatic meaning as, okay? As sara is the essence, so sarato meaning as the essence, okay? And so this is used very commonly. Would you see this as self, atato, okay? Would you see this as, you should contemplate this as empty, sunyato, okay? You should contemplate this as impermanent, anichato, okay? And so this is this idiomatic usage of an ablative, which is both idiomatic in terms of the form and also in terms of the meaning. Okay, right. Do you speak only of what you have known, seen, and understood for yourselves? Yes, Bhante. Samang nyatang, oneself known. Samang vyatang, oneself seen. Samang viditang, oneself understood. Okay, yes, Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, bhikkhu. So now you've been guided by me, upanita. Okay? Upanita, guided by me with this Dhamma, which is visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection and onward leading to be experienced by the wise for themselves. For it was with reference to this that it has been said, because this Dhamma is visible here and now, sanditiko akaliko ehi pasiko upanayiko pachatang vedita bo vinyuhi di. Okay? Right. Next section is on the starting. So what we've done now is we've gone from this idea of consciousness as this kind of entity which travels in this kind of self same way through samsara, getting reborn here and there, and we're now looking at consciousness as a kind of conditioned process which is going through like a development or an evolution, okay, and in not as something self-sufficient, but as something that's intertwined with these whole bunch of other factors, okay, which are all conditioned and related to each other. And this has been talked about in quite an abstract way. So dependent origination usually is quite abstract, okay. Now the Buddha is giving quite an interesting and unique sort of concrete exemplification of this. He's saying, okay, we've talked about it in the abstract. Now let's look at what actually is, have a real world application of what this same thing is talking about. Tirnang kopana bhikkhave sannipata gabhas avakanti hoti. Okay, with three things, tirnang sannipata, coming together. So sun together, ni down, pata falling. Okay, so sannipata meaning gathering together. Okay, gabhas avakanti hoti. Ava, down, kanti is going. Gabha, okay, here means the embryo. Okay, so gaba means either embryo or a womb, okay, or an inner chamber, a storehouse, yeah, isn't a targeted garba, is the storehouse, or the chitti garba, they call the earth store, yeah, is a gaba, yeah. So gaba savakanti, so the appearance of the embryo, so this word avakanti, of course, always using to mean conception or rebirth, okay, so the rebirth of the embryo. And gives the three conditions. Here the mother and father come together. The mother is fertile, uteni utuni hoti. Okay. And the gandhaba cha nacha pachi pachito hoti. So this goes through different combinations. So if the mother's not fertile, then and the gandhaba is not there, then there's no conception. If the mother is fertile but the gandhaba is not there, then there's no conception. But when the mother and father come together, the mother is fertile and the gandhaba is ready or waiting or prepared, then the three things coming together, there is the gabhasavakanti, the appearance in the womb. So of course the controversial or difficult part of this particular passage is the gandhaba. What does gandhaba mean? And of course gandhaba usually being a kind of celestial musician. So we have Panchasika, the Gandhaba, who comes down to serenade the Buddha with his lute and sing him love songs and things like that. So this is a Gandhaba. So maybe that's what this means. Maybe what it means is that at the time of birth, you have celestial angels coming down and singing songs with their guitars. And if the celestial musicians are not ready to serenade, then there's no conception. Do you think that's right? Yeah. Don't think so. Yeah. So what does Gandhaba mean? Well, grammatically, it looks a bit like a word. Gandha means to smell or fragrant, and Gandhaba looks a little bit like a verbal form meaning to be smelt. So it could mean like a fragrant one. That's one possible interpretation. But it's probably not the right interpretation. Best singette on this was done by Widyasekara years ago in his book Buddhist and Vedic Studies, which I just had a look for and couldn't find a while ago. But he has a whole chapter on the Gandhaba, and essentially what he shows is that the Gandhaba in Sanskrit is called the Gandharva, okay? And the Gandharva is very old Vedic conception, and was like some kind of spirit or fairy or kind of something like some kind of divine being, but also came to be used possibly originally for the spirit or the of a dead person, so you're a kind of ghost in that kind of sense, and became used in a very wide variety of senses. So what it seems is that you've actually just got a couple of references in Buddhism to this Gandhaba, but there's no real context that gives you to understand it. But if you look at all the Vedic context, then you can see how it's understood. And the interesting thing is that he shows that the Gandharva in Sanskrit is probably in Greek pronounced Kantaura, which is, of course, what we know as the centaur. Okay, so the centaur in English is probably originally the same as the Gandhaba. It's usually understood as being the rebirth consciousness. That's usually how they explain it. And I think that's probably correct explanation. And it probably was used as an idiom. One thing about this passage is that there's another place in the Majjhima Nikaya where there's a group of Brahmins, ancient Brahmin rishis, who are sitting around, and they say, how does rebirth happen? And they describe rebirth in exactly the same terms as this. So this is actually an ancient Brahmanical belief which has been adopted by the Buddha and put within his system, okay? And so again, you notice that context of what's going on in that time. So in this case, this is almost like an animist way of thinking about it. The Gandhaba is thinking of it in terms of a spirit or something like that. And so this is like an ordinary language way of thinking about it, okay? This is like a popular exposition. When the Buddha was talking about it more scientifically or more technically, he used the word consciousness, but when he's talking about it in this more ordinary language way, this is when he introduces the word Gandhaba. Okay? So then the mother carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Okay? Garubhara. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's vinaya. Okay. So that's quite a very striking passage. Tamena jatam and is born, sakena lohitena poseti, with her own blood, notice the instrumental case. Sakena lohitena, with her own blood, nourishes it. Lohitana eva, it's called blood in the noble one's discipline, that is to say the mother's milk. And that's also very, I think, very scientifically correct, because I think the blood and the milk are actually chemically almost identical in their composition, or very similar anyway. When he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy ploughs, tip cat, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy cars, toy bow and arrow, Xboxes, and so on. Okay, so kids haven't changed all that much in the kinds of things, the ratakang that they're playing with, the toy cars and so on. And toy bow and arrow, they're playing around, running around, shooting each other with their guns. So as they run, shooting each other with pretend lasers and things like that. So not much has changed there. When he grows up and his faculties mature still further, the youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. Forms cognizable by the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. Okay. Now, so what we're seeing here is this is obviously a developmental process. Okay. So this is one place where in dependent origination we're quite explicitly being told that this is a part of child development and infant development, and what we're looking at, this kind of whole thing. Now, if our interpretation is correct and the Gandhaba is the rebirth consciousness, then this is the start, this is picking up dependent origination with the link of consciousness and the development of Nama Rupa in the womb, okay? Consciousness and Nama Rupa, and then being born, and then, of course, then it specifically mentions the six sense bases, okay? Interesting study that was done in Italy a number of years ago with identical twins, and they found out that even identical twins, when they're in the womb, have different personalities. Okay, so they're genetically identical, and they've got an identical environment, and yet one will be more aggressive and one's more passive, or something like that. One will move more and the other's more passive. And how do you explain that? They're physically identical, and they'll keep those character traits even throughout their whole life. And if you study them throughout their whole life, you find like at 40 years old, the aggressive one is still aggressive and the passive one is still passive. You know? It makes you wonder. Now, and again, playing tehi kilati, he plays with those toys. So here we have tehi, and it's very unfortunate that Eve is not with us today, because he was finally reaching her favourite ehi form, and she's just not here to enjoy it. So ehi being the instrumental plural, okay? So tehi, with those, okay? So playing with those toys. Kumara kanang kila panakahi, panakani, kila panakani, kila meaning play. Rufuka is rata, meaning chariot. Yeah, but they still use it today, like in Thailand, it's a rot, is a car, which is from the same root. Yeah, so they still use it. Now, on seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it if it was pleasing and dislikes it if it was unpleasing. So here we go to the feeling and craving, yeah, links of dependent origination. Okay, so from sense basis to feeling and craving. He abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished. Anupatita kaya sati. Okay, his body mindfulness not established. And his mind is constricted and limited. And he does not understand as it actually is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Okay? So this describing most of us every day. Right? Engaged as he is in favouring and opposing whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, delight arises in him. Now delight in feelings is clinging. With his clinging as condition, there comes to be being. with being as conditioned as birth, with birth as conditioned, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this entire mass of suffering. So here, having started out seemingly at some distance from dependent origination, yeah, with this kind of story about getting born in the womb and then playing with toys and things, and gradually he's kind of brought it around until finally it's unified it with dependent origination right at the end, and the link being the craving and attachment to the feelings of pain or painful or pleasant feelings that one experiences through the senses. And so as for the eye, then repeats that for the ear, nose, tongue, body and mind. Okay, so this is the origin of suffering. Now, interestingly, it then goes on to talking about from the origin of suffering, it's now talking about the ending of suffering, but also approaches the ending of suffering in a typically unusual or striking way for this particular sutta. Normally, of course, it just says, you know, with the ending of ignorance, there's the ending of sankharas, the ending of sankharas, the ending of consciousness and so on, and this is the ending of all this suffering. But here, it's talking about the arising of the Tathagata in the world. And so it's actually talking about an arising, upajati, as being part of the cessation sequence, which is a very interesting way of putting it. And it relates to such things as the Upanisa Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, which also continues the arising sequence to the arising of a series, so having a arising of birth, and then aging, death and suffering. It says suffering giving rise to faith. Faith gives rise to sadness. Sadness gives rise to joy. Joy gives rise to happiness. Happiness gives rise to samadhi. Samadhi gives rise to seeing things as they really are. Attachment, letting go, and freedom. Yeah? So actually, suffering is the beginning of the path. It's nice, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with...
Faith first.
But you've got to have suffering first. Yeah. Yeah, and you got to be sad. You got to have suffering first, and then faith can arise. It's good, isn't it? I like it anyway. If you don't like it, I don't care. Right. So, and then goes through the whole of the gradual training, which we've been through before. I won't go through that again now. And of course, the very beautiful teachings on Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Now, the interesting bit is that this. It comes up here and up to the four jhanas. Okay? And I'll just read through here. So, jhakkhuna rupa. So, after having gone to the fourth jhana, then having seen an eye with a form, one does not lust after pleasing forms, and one is not averse to unpleasing forms. One has mindfulness of the body established and a measureless consciousness, a measureless heart. And then one understands that it really is a release of heart released by wisdom, where these unwholesome dhammas without remainder cease. And then thus anurodha virodha vipahino. This is anurodha is favoring, so anu having the idea of going along with, vi having the idea of against. So anurodha virodha, favoring and opposing, having abandoned, favoring and opposing. Whatever feeling one feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that feeling one does not delight in, one does not rejoice in, one does not remain holding on to it. Okay, and then delight ends and attachment ends and birth, aging and death and so on all comes to an end. So this is very interesting that it goes straight from the gradual training as being the ending of suffering leading up to the fourth jhana, and then that process of developing insight emerging from that to being able to see through the nature of these feelings. Now, this is one bit where the Pali and the Chinese are slightly different, and I'll just read Venerable Anālaya's comments here. Both versions next turn to the Tathagata arising in the world, which the Pali version treats in detail by giving a full account of the gradual path of training. The Madhyama Agama version, however, has only a short statement on the Tathagata arising in the world and gaining full awakening, after which it continues straight away with the Tathagata being unattached in relation to feelings, endowed with mindfulness of the body and a broad mind, understanding deliverance of the mind and deliverance through wisdom. a statement found in the Pali version at the end of the exposition of the gradual path of training. When evaluating this difference between the two versions, it would seem that the Pali version's full account of the gradual path of training is not required at this point. The whole discourse in both versions being mainly concerned with the topic of dependent arising. Moreover, the need to stay aloof from likes and dislikes in regard to sensory experience forms already part of the gradual path under the heading of sense restraint, so that in the Pali version the same topic occurs twice, once as part of the gradual path description and then again in the final passage found in both versions on being unattached in regard to whatever feelings arise in the sense doors. In this way, establishment of mindfulness of the body and aloofness from likes and dislikes with regard to sensory experience comes in the Pali discourse after the successful attainment of the four jhanas, whereas from the viewpoint of actual practice, the reverse sequence would be expected. It would moreover be easier to imagine that during the process of oral recitation, the introductory passage on the Tathagata arising in the world caused the reciting monk to unintentionally expand this with a full exposition of the gradual path, than it is to imagine that such a long and well-known exposition was omitted. In view of these arguments, the Chinese version appears to have preserved the more convincing account of this part of the discourse. Okay? So according to Venerable Nario's argument, we have the two versions. One, both of them start out with the Tathagata arising in the world, and then with and both finishing in a similar way. Okay, so the essential, what's there, the meaning of what's there is still essentially the same. The difference is whether we include all of the in-between stuff. And I think Analeo is certainly correct in saying that the in-between stuff is less sort of directly related to the main subject matter of the sutta, so I think that's fair enough. I'm not so convinced by his other arguments that he uses, though. When he says that, first of all, the argument that the non-attachment to the six sense bases and the arising of mindfulness of the body belongs in the middle of the gradual training rather than at the end, I think it belongs in both places, and it's something which is developed in the middle of the gradual training and is perfected at the end of it, and so I don't see any particular problem with mentioning that twice in two ways, and there are other places where similar things happen. His thing on the nature of the oral recitation, that it's more likely that this would be inserted by accident rather than it should be dropped out by accident, I definitely disagree with that. I think it's very possible, and in fact happens quite frequently, that such passages would be either inserted or dropped out. You could easily have the monks having the full passage. They've already recited this whole passage, right? And so just as we've decided, well, we're not going to go and discuss the whole of the gradual training here because we've already done it. And so this is what the monks would do. They would abbreviate it and not go through the whole thing. And so it's very easy in that case to forget that that long passage actually belongs there. So I think that either way it could happen, either by accident or by the deliberate choice of the redactors, that such a passage could be included or not included. I don't think that's a decisive argument. So in the end, I'm not so convinced by Venerable Analia's arguments in that point. I think either way of presenting could be valid.
I was thinking that the arising of the Tathagata could be in the context of dependent origination, because dependent origination is very complex, and one of the aspects of dependent origination is liberation.
Yep.
And that would be part of dependent liberation.
Yep, absolutely.
How you get to liberation is dependent on many things.
Yep.
And so that's one thing that Bhikkhu Bodhi, I think, talks about in his book about dependent origination, is that it's part of the path system that's kind of forgotten or not about enough.
Yep.
Is dependent
liberation. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely, I agree with that totally. And just because normally or most commonly the gradual training and dependent origination are taught separately, doesn't mean that at sometimes the Buddha wouldn't have brought them together to show the relationship between them. Absolutely.
Because it's all very well talking about dependent origination, but how do you get there?
Yeah.
How do you get to that understanding?
Yeah. So this is the ending of that whole mass of suffering. Anyway, I like it, so that's the main thing. Thus, is because this release through the ending of craving, you should bear in mind, in brief, sankhitena, Okay? So this is the one in brief, right? And but this Sati, the fisherman's son, is caught up in this great net of craving. What does it say? The great net of craving, then the trammel of craving. Oh, he's really lost it.
Andre, could I say something?
Yes.
Which
of course you may.
Probably can't be answered now because we probably don't have time, but I'll just say it anyway.
Go.
If one is supposed to be equanimous and not have aversion to, you know, unpleasurable physical sensations, etc.
Mm.
Yeah. I just wonder if the Buddha subjected himself to extreme physical pain for many years. And then at the end of all that, he attained enlightenment. And I just wonder if subjecting himself to all that physical pain might have actually, although he said it didn't make a difference, I just wonder if maybe it did.
Yeah.
And this notion of lying on a bed of nails, and also what Ian Gawler speaks about, which is physical pain, you just register as being a physical sensation, don't call it pain anymore.
Right.
I mean, he meditated, used meditation to put aside the pain of bone cancer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was just wondering if to reach this state of non attachment, if you sort of strain the state of practices, maybe it helps you.
Try it and see. Try it and see. I think there is something to that, and you know, there's no doubt that if you relate to those things in the same way, in a useful way, then you know, there's so many accounts of people who did get wisdom through, you know, whatever, being, you know, in wartime or, you know, drought or, you know, kind of extreme circumstances, illness and things, and so get a lot of wisdom from it. But it always depends on, in the end, it always depends on your actual response to it. And I think that's really the point. You can learn in those situations, but the actual thing is, what's your response to it, or what's your attitude? So remember that when they were doing those ascetic practices, their main idea wasn't to learn and understand through doing it. Their main idea was simply to torture themselves, to burn off their past karma. And so it didn't necessarily have, either to burn off their past karma or even more to get powers, so they wanted to get the psychic powers and stuff. So, I mean, certainly in the Thai forest tradition, they emphasize that a lot, you know.
You sit down and you just experience pain and it's so much until your mind just retreats and
Yeah, as Ajahn Mahabhu's teaching. And other monks as well. One time when someone came to Ajahn Chah, he said, what do you teach? Do you teach samatha? He said, no. He said, do you teach vipassana? He said, no. I don't teach vipassana. He said, well, what do you teach? He said, I teach torture. But it's all, you know, it's all still pretty mild. You know? It's like one meal a day. It's not, you know, it's not like just fasting. You can, you know, it's different from standing on one leg for 3 years without moving. I mean, it's all a matter of degree. You know, there's a story about, have I told you the story when Ajahn Jaisari was on wandering around India on Tudong? Ajahn Jaisara is very, among his many other wonderful qualities, very strong determination and very kind of ascetic in many ways. And one time Ajahn Chah got very sick. So everyone thought he was going to die in a few days. So Ajahn Jaisara said, okay, out of honour for Ajahn Chah, I'm not going to lie down until after Ajahn Chah dies. And then Ajahn Chah got better. Right? 7 years later, Ajahn Chah's still alive. Well, he's in a coma the whole time, but he wasn't dead. So Ajahn Jaisara did sit his practice for many years and didn't lie down. And his judgment of it is bad for your knees, bad for your kidneys, bad for your back, bad for your neck, bad for your meditation. But he still did it. And one time when he went on Tudong in India, wandering around India with Ajahn Pasuna, because they had many funny stories, you know, like they first arrived in Mumbai or something like that, and they were supposed to meet somebody who was going to take them to Bodh Gaya. I can't remember where it was. They were going to take them somewhere. So many years ago I heard this story. But the person that they were supposed to meet didn't show up. There was nobody there. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any contacts. They had nothing. So they just walked. So they just walked from Mumbai to Gaya or wherever it was. One place they got to this... village, and it was towards the evening, and he sort of arrived there, and the villagers sort of put him up, gave him a place to stay, and there was an ascetic staying in a little, it had a little hall thing, just a concrete hall, and he put Ajahn Jayasaro in there and said, you know, you can stay here for the night. And so there was this kind of, I don't know if he was a naked ascetic or wearing a loincloth or something like that, and he was just sort of doing this kind of walking meditation, and it was just a bare concrete room with one light globe hanging in the middle of it, burning, and this ascetic walking backwards and forwards, and like a swing thing, right, ropes hanging down with a bar across it. And Ajahn Jayasaro had been walking all day and he was really exhausted, and so he just kind of, you know, leaned up against the wall, you know, put his legs out and tried to get some sleep while he's kind of sitting up there. And, you know, this kind of ascetic was walking backwards and forwards, and I was thinking, when the hell is he going to get some rest, you know? Is this guy going to lie down or something like that? And he's sort of trying to, you know, he's just sitting on a concrete floor and leaning there and trying to sleep like this, you know? And, oh, God, when's this guy going to get some rest, you know? And after a while, the fellow would like lean on the swing like this. You know, so he'd go back and forth, and then he realized this fellow never sat down. Right? He was just only two postures, standing and walking. And he'd done that, I think, for 11 years or something like that. Just walking backwards and forwards, and then when he rested, he'd just lean on the swing and get some rest.
So he felt that his practice was extremely effective. Three postures, and this guy's got two postures.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkho